Hello and welcome. Thank you for tuning in to the best in paranormal podcasting. This is Darkness Radio. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. Along with me, as always, Tim Dennis. Tim, in a few minutes, we're going to be joined by Joseph Stewart. We're going to be talking about demons. And I wanted to cover a quick story that came out available to me after we had already recorded our Supernatural News segment. But I thought this was a pretty fascinating tale, and I wanted to explore it real quickly. Kind of a news story has popped up and become available. In 1993, a taped confession never before made public by Albert Einstein's assistant in the summer of 1947 made the stunning admission that she and the professor were flown to Roswell, New Mexico under government direction and examined the debris and bodies resulting from the crash of an extraterrestrial vehicle. The interview of the assistant can be listened to below in the article. I'm going to have this article up on Darkness Radio. Just go to the news tab and it'll be the last story listed there. So make sure you go click it. You can read the entire article and have the link to the audio and bit. Shirley Wright, just so you know, is the assistant to Albert Einstein. She held two PhDs, one in chemistry, one in physical sciences, and she led a very good life and a productive life. They have the information from her obituary there. It's really interesting. Her Roswell story was originally told by the late UFO researcher Leonard Stringfield in entries in his privately published early 1990s status report UFO Crash Retrievals monograph series. He gave Einstein's assistant the pseudonym Edith Simpson to protect her name and family's privacy. But Stringfield did mention in his book the name of the researchers in Florida who met with Dr. Wright to interview her, a woman named Sheila Franklin. Franklin was active in the state's mutual UFO network, the MUFON organization. Stringfield and Franklin collaborated to document what the woman had to say. Franklin and Wright had shared a mutual friend, and it is through this connection that Franklin had learned that Wright had mentioned that she and Einstein had made the Roswell trip. The friend arranged for Franklin and Wright to meet. Franklin taped Wright's Roswell testimony when the two arranged to get together in Miami, Florida in 1993. And it was hoped that the Sheila Franklin and Stringfield mentioned as the interviewer of Einstein's assistant was still alive. And if she was, hopefully she could be located. So after utilizing several online directories and after many calls, Franklin actually located and reached out, initially somewhat skeptical of the call. Once the intent of the reach out to her was understood, she became more forthcoming. She explained that not only did she have notes of her interview with Einstein's assistant, but that she had actually recorded it and still had the tapes. Even more, she was willing to try to find the now nearly 30-year-old interview tapes and send them out to the interviewer so that the world could hear this. Thankfully, after great effort, Franklin did find an email, a file of one of those interviews. Other portions of Wright's testimony were committed to print in Stringfield's monograph and related. Unfortunately, the second tape of Wright has not been located despite Franklin's best efforts. This article goes very deep and in depth into what they experienced, what they have there. And there is the audio. The tape is pretty compelling. We're not going to play that aspect of the audio because they're about 10 and 8 minutes long each one, but that is there. You can go listen to this. However, Frank Edwards was an early radio pioneer and author of several UFO books, including the classic UFO Serious Business. He was a household name across America in the 50s and 60s, and in a lecture given to a Detroit, Michigan audience in 1956, Edwards made statements about Einstein that he believed to be true based upon his sources and his understanding of historical circumstance. And these statements are nothing short of remarkable. Edwards maintained that just 4 years prior, in 1952, Albert Einstein had delivered an urgent message to then President Harry Truman, taking strong interest in the UFO phenomena. Einstein warned that Truman's shoot down policy of UFOs over DC was unwise. This extremely rare 2-minute recording is available. We're going to play that for you right now.
It discusses a great many of these sightings around Washington, D.C., particularly those of mid-July 1952, when about a dozen of the things came over. About a dozen of them came over one night. They were tracked by radar. They were seen visually. They followed the planes in, and according to the CAA's own booklet, the pilots got good looks at the things as they followed them in and out of the airport. Some of them hovered. Some of them went around the Capitol building. Some went over the monument and the White House and over the deep freeze and circled all around there. They were seen plainly. There was no question about them being there. And as a matter of fact, the officials were so concerned about it that on the following morning, they issued a shoot 'em down order. Why didn't they shoot 'em down the first night? They didn't shoot 'em down because the jets couldn't catch them, and they've never been able to catch one yet. The jets couldn't catch them. The next night they showed up. The jets didn't go up after them. They didn't go up with their shoot 'em down order for the simple reason that Alfred Einstein and others of comparable standing heard about the shoot 'em down order because the story was on the front pages all over the world. They heard about this shoot 'em down order and they personally got in touch with the little man in the White House. And I know what Mr. Einstein told him. He said, "Mr. President, anyone who can cross millions of miles of space will be able to take care of himself after he gets there. Don't start something you can't finish." That was one time that Give 'em Hell Harry decided it would be better not to give 'em any hell.
Awesome audio, interesting story. That link is up at darknessradio.com under the news tab for yesterday's program. So you can go there and actually hear that audio, read the article in its entirety, and you can access some of Wright's testimony that could be heard from the original tapes. So I think there's two audio bits there, a 10-minute bit and an 8-minute bit. So go check it out for yourself. Amazing stuff. Let's get started. Thank you so much for your patience. For our guest is Joseph Stewart joining us now. And today we're going to journey into the realm of demons with a real demon hunter. Joseph Stewart is here to talk to us about this and shed some light on some of the misnomers and the realities of demons. Since we are in October, Tim, I figured what a good way to start off the creepiest month of the year. Let's dive right in with demons. Joseph Stewart, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Fascinating stuff. I'm just curious, you know, obviously there have been a lot of questions raised over the years that were aliens or are aliens, demons or angels. And after hearing what you've just heard and this newer story kind of popping up, what is your thoughts?
Well, I'm very familiar with ufology. I was involved in MUFON, APRO. I worked on the transcription project with alien abduction, and I don't think they're connected at all.
All right. So you don't believe that aliens and demon realm are, in fact, the same beings?
No, I don't.
Okay. You know, if I could ask you as well then, Joseph, just kind of going off of that, a lot of mainstream religions will have you believe that ghosts, things that we encounter in hauntings, are in fact demons, that there are no such things as disincarnate souls, that our consciousness, our being does not exist after death, but these are demons creating this illusion. Where do you fall in on that theory?
Well, that theory is very much the Muslims with the jinn, where they believe ghosts are one type of jinn. I believe ghosts are deceased human beings. I don't think they're demons, because demons are totally different.
All right. The book, by the way, is called Demons, A Secular Look. We have a link up for that book in today's program guide and a link to our guest's website. I'm curious. Let's dig into this real quickly, Joseph. First of all, I want to know your background on this. How does someone become a researcher and work in the field of demon and demon hunter?
Well, I've always had an interest in the paranormal since I was a child. And if you read my bio, there's a lot of interest in ghosts and UFOs and crypto. And I was mainly interested in the ghosts. And that was my research for many, many years. And I came across a person that I was working with involved in the haunting at his house. And it kind of led me to the demon. I didn't believe in it, but as I studied it and as time went on, I learned that it is very real.
And the concept of a demon, what is the actual, I guess, definition that you would give to what a demon really is?
Well, I base my definition or classifications on their behavior. In the past, they've used a variety of different ways to classify them. But it basically, it's an entity that hates mankind. They're very much part of our culture. They're not just, you know, one demon or 72 demons. There's a lot more than that, and they coexist with us. And they're predators. They look for opportunity to make our lives miserable. And that's about the best way I can describe them. There's some theories out there as far as what they are. It would be along the lines like, okay, what's a ghost? It's intangible. It's intangible sometimes. I don't have an answer for that. I speculate on some things. Some things make more sense when you put it in the realm of quantum physics, showing that it is possible.
Well, do you, you know, there's an interesting concept we've been looking into in the research field, that what people consider to be demons are really the cast-off aspects and elements of our own souls. You know, obviously, when we die, if we are going to heaven or going to the next evolution, the best part of us, the purest, the cleanest, the essence of that pure soul will be what moves on. And what's left behind then? Is that what becomes demonic? Is it the dark shadow of what we once were? The fractured souls, the tortured element of who we are that's left behind that becomes part of this realm?
No, I don't think so at all. Kind of what you're talking about, I would put in along the lines of what's called a topla. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
Yeah, topas. We've talked a lot about that thought
yes.
form creatures, and right?
I have run into those. No, the demonic has never been human. It's never walked the earth as a human being. It's something totally different. And it remains hidden. That's why we don't much about them.
All right, well, what about these elements of humanity? Ghosts that are seen that, listen, grandma was a very sweet, loving person. I mean, sure, she had bad days and was, you know, could be a pistol. But, you know, people are seeing grandma's spirits at a location, but she seems darker. She seems more animal base instinct, right? She's very get out and banging walls and flickering lights. Is this that shadow form of ourselves, or is this a demon in guise as something we would recognize, something we would maybe feel more comfortable being around?
Well, my experience is that however the individual is in life, they will be in death if they become a ghost. Death does not reboot your personality. You are in death as you are in life, and that is as a ghost. Mm-hmm. So if there was that much of a difference in the individual, then I would be suspicious that it's a demon pretending to be grandma. But then that would have to be verified.
So are demons, in fact, fallen angels? Are they this element of God's core group that just were cast away? Or is it something different that we're dealing with?
Well, see, this is the problem. This is why I call it a secular look. Because when you start putting it in a religious context, you're limited by the dogma. And therefore, you don't get a clear picture of what you're actually studying because you're going to be eliminating things. You filter it. And therefore, they're in all cultures and there's all different origin stories. Mm-hmm. And other than a Christian like the Muslim, it was actually a race that once lived here on Earth long before man. So it depends on the culture you're talking about. But they are in every culture and every religion in some form or another.
All right, but so each one of these different cultures and beliefs just describes a different name to them or a different philosophy as to what they are and how they exist. So you're looking at the secular version of this, but kind of exposing the demon realm for what it truly is.
Correct.
Okay. Have you had a personal encounter with a demon?
Yeah, I have quite a few, actually.
All right. Walk me through your first experiences. How old were you when this took place?
This would have been 2015, 2016, around in there. I don't know how old that would have been. I'm 67 right now.
Okay. All right. So you're going back, 6-7 years in having this experience. Was this something that you were seeking, or was it something that sought you out?
Actually, I wasn't seeking it. It wasn't seeking me. It just happened to be, I was doing a favor for a friend investigating a house that was haunted. And they're talking about, she thought there was demons involved. I didn't believe in demons. I thought it was just her background. And when I got
What was her account? What led her to believe it was demonic before you tell us what your experience was?
She was being raped almost every night. Spectral rape, if you want to call it that.
Wow. Okay.
It would descend from the ceiling upon her. And
out of curiosity, then, why would you ascribe that to her secular beliefs? I mean, obviously, this doesn't sound like just a ghost. I mean, there are not, I know there are spectral sexual encounters that have happened, and many mm-hmm. people have claimed to have had them. But, those seem to be a collaborative effort where the person allowed themselves and gave over to the spirit. These demonic rapes, this much more forceful aspect of it. Why would you think that only had to do with her religious belief? Did you think there was a chance this could just be a over-sexualized ghost?
No, she described it as demonic. That's the way she saw it, a sex demon. And through my experience, I had never heard anything like she was describing. So I just had an open mind about it, but I was still inclined to think, I wasn't really quite sure what was going on there. Actually, I did in a sense that I thought it might be related to something, some trauma from her past that was causing these terrifying dreams.
So you were just chalking it up to dreams, not that this could have been a physical reality.
Yeah, those terror dreams, yeah.
Okay. Was she showing signs of physical assault, or did it just seem psychological and, misinterpreted?
We did not get into the physical aspect. She was very quiet about that. And I had reason to believe there was a lot of psychological reasons behind it.
Okay, so you were looking at all aspects of the possibilities, that there might have been a psychological aspect to what was taking place. Now, you go there as a friend to investigate these claims. What tips the scales for you that it's not just somebody's mental condition or dreams, but that you are definitely encountering the demonic realm?
Well, I went to the house, and I was going to take a ghost group in, bring the equipment in, and just kind of measure and see what was going on. But that they weren't available at that time, so I was going to go on my own and just kind of do some EVP work. And something told me, don't do that. You got to take somebody with you. So I got a hold of a friend of mine, Pam, who was a psychic, and I worked with before, and she's very good. So I took her with me. When I got to this house, it was up for sale at the time, and I was given a key to be able to get into the home. And when I turned the lock to open it up, it would relock itself. And it did this like 3 times. And then after that happened, and then the deadbolt got thrown. And I thought, oh, geez, somebody must be in the house. But I couldn't see anybody in the house. I called the man's name's Jason, which was her boyfriend who was selling the place for her. And he had given me another key, so I was able to get in through the back door. And then I was waiting for Pam to show up. And she called me and said that she didn't understand what was going on because she'd been there before. And she got all confused. It was in the fog, and she was lost in the city and didn't know how to get back. And so it was just like all these delays going on. So when we got into the environment, and we started up at the top floor, and then that's the room where this woman was being attacked. Now, initially, like I told you, I wasn't a believer in the demonic. There had to be some other reason for it, psychological or otherwise. And the boyfriend, Jason, was telling me when him and this woman was staying in her house before they moved into the house that I met them at, she was being attacked at night and would always start off in this terror and her screaming and stuff. And I thought, well, she's just having these night terrors. And then he told me, well, one night she's screaming and then I hear this other voice talking on top of her at the time this was happening. And then that gave me pause. I'm like, wow, what's going on here? Because I really trusted this guy and as a good observer, and I was just kind of puzzled by that.
So this guy, he heard an audible secondary voice that was not her screaming, but something else that was tormenting her.
Yes. Yes.
Why didn't he go into the room?
I can't answer that.
Okay.
I mean, the thing about the demonic, there's a lot of manipulation that goes on.
Right.
There's a lot of confusion that goes on. So people don't do what you think they would normally do.
Right. And I understand that because there's probably a lot of people right now that are thinking, well, if I hear my spouse screaming, I hear the person I love screaming, I would kick in that door and find out what's going on, what's taking place. But it's not always that simple. Sometimes by doing that, being in that moment, you're so petrified and terrified, especially if you're hearing another more terrifying sound coming from that room, panic takes over. And there is the fight or flight response for everyone.
Or just basically in shock and just don't react at all.
Mm-hmm. And if it's truly a demonic creature, maybe you're repelled or held from doing something. I know that people that have claimed to have been in the vicinity of the demonic feel almost like they're slogging through quicksand. Their mind is slowed down. Their response movements are slowed down. It just becomes almost impossible for them to be able to do anything.
Yes, that's very true.
Okay, so now you're hearing this. What takes it to the next step for you?
Well, anyway, so we were there, and you being a ghost hunter, you know that ghosts are busybodies, and if there's ghosts in the environment, they're going to talk. You're going to get EVPs. So you're going to get something. And everything is just, I'm not getting anything. Everything's just zero. I can't pick up on anything. And the psychic says, there's something here, but it's hidden. I don't know what it is. I don't know, but there is something here. So my friend had given me this 14-inch crucifix they had blessed by the Pope, and he wanted me to take it for protection. So I brought it along with me, and she was holding on to it. And we were walking through the home, and we went into the bedroom where the events took place. And I had told her nothing about this. And she's looking up at the ceiling. She says, whatever this thing is, it's attacking from the ceiling. It's dropping down on top of this woman, whatever it is. And we got back out of that room, was going through the other parts of the house, and all of a sudden she stopped and she turned to me and she says, the crucifix and the holy water is not going to help you. She says this to me, and I'm saying, excuse me? What did you say to me? And she says, what do you mean? What are you talking about? She didn't even remember what she said. We went back into the room. Now this thing seems to be talking, and she's telling me, narrating all the stuff that's happening to this woman and other people that were in the house before that. She started telling all this stuff. And I said to her, I said, this sounds like an incubus. And as soon as I said that, you could feel that whole room change in energy. It's like it just spiked. Her face just went white. And she was yelling, how did you know? How did you know? And I'm like, well, I don't understand what you're talking about. She says, it's pissed because you figured out it was an incubus and it's going to kill you where you stand. So at that point, I'm backing away from her and she's saying it's planning on throwing you over we were on the second floor, going to throw you over the railing down to the floor below. But in my mind, I just had this sense that, no, it ain't. She's going to stab me through the heart with that crucifix because it's like about a oh, I don't know, about 3/8 of an inch twisted steel, and they had a long end on it, so it would work very well as a dagger. And I saw this face superimposed on hers briefly, and it just, you know, startled me, and I backed up, and she keeps fighting it, trying to fight it off and fight it off and fight it off. She finally was able to hold it at bay. And so I talked with it, and I said, look, I don't mean any harm. We're just here doing an investigation for a friend. We're not here to hurt you or anything of this nature. And that seemed to calm it down. So at that point, it got very talkative. It was like, I really want you guys to go down in the basement. There's something I want to show you. And of course, the hair's on the back of my neck.
Jesus.
I says, damn way I'm going in that basement, you know. And
right.
Just telling us as we're going through these rooms. Now, the one other thing that was very interesting was there was high electromagnetic field in that house initially. We later on thought it might have been a ground issue, but we had an electrician checked it out. There wasn't anything involved with that. So we eventually get back down to the bottom stairs, and I'm talking with her, and she was telling me some other demonic stuff. And it was like this thing was getting excited about her stories. And I started feeling something behind me. And I said to her, where's this incubus now? Where is it? And she says, it's standing right behind you. And I spun around the camera hoping I'd be able to capture something, but I didn't capture anything. And she tells me, we need to go into the kitchen. That's the safe spot. So at this point, I've lost all confidence and trust with her because I could tell she's really being manipulated by this thing. So I decided, you know what? We're going to call this. We need to get out of here. We're above our heads right now. We got to figure out what's going on here and make better plans. And so I was going to leave by the front door where I had all the problems with the bolts and stuff. And for some reason, I kept walking towards the back door where there's a landing, and went down in the basement. And I said, why am I going to this back door? What? This thing's manipulating me. And I see this white stuff. It looked like compound that was on the doorknob, and it wasn't there before. I thought, my first inclination was to go investigate it, which means I'd have to get on that landing where the stairs are. And I said, I'm not going to do it. So I took my camera and I used the zoom. I could not get it to focus on that stuff that was on the doorknob. Move the camera off to other parts of the room, and it focuses fine with zoom. I go back to that. I can't focus it. So at that moment, I'm like, I'm done. I'm out of here. And Pam comes walking by me like in a daze, like she's just strolling through a field. And she goes right to the stairs, the landing. I'm yelling at her. And right at that moment, when I get up to where she's at, we see this black mist, and it's mixing, like it's swirling about, and it takes this form of this huge black dog with the most burning red eyes you've ever seen. And the breath was foul, and you could hear the weight as it's rushing up the stairs to attack her. I don't know if she fainted or what she did, but she started falling downstairs and was able to grab her by the collar and pull her back into the room. Well, later on, once she got her senses about her, she was all upset. She said, it knew. And I said, knew what? She says, I have a great fear of the black dogs, you know, the black shucks. The spirit, the spectral dogs of England, those types of places. And so at that point, I said, come on, we got to get out of here. So we will go out the front door, and it was just a feeling, it was very strange. You were just kind of like, as you describe, almost like you're moving through mud or soup. And I got out of the place, locked it up. I said, come on, let's go somewhere where we can sit down and have some coffee and talk about this. So we drive, I don't know, it wasn't very far, like maybe a mile down the road, and there was a Wendy's there. And I pull up the window to get some coffee for us. And as I pulled up, the lady goes, ha, the strangest thing just happened. All of our computers crashed. And she looks at me, says, Joe, we're not far enough away. We got to get further away. I says, well, I think it's just a coincidence. You know, I don't think it has anything to do with demonic. So we went on to a McDonald's 5 more miles down the road. We pull into the McDonald's, and all the power goes out in the building. And I can see all the people milling about. And she looks at me, says, it's not far enough. We have to keep going. So we ended up 20 miles away to a gas station, and we had some coffee, and we just stood out there. It was well past midnight, trying to get our thoughts together. We finally get home, and she, as well as I, were very irritable, drained of energy, quick to anger. And about 3 days later, it was almost like you were in a vacuum, and all of a sudden you're filled with energy and you were back to normal again. But it took 3 days for that to happen. That was my first real encounter.
Man, that is baptism by fire.
Yeah, it was.
you get involved in something like that, right? Obviously very traumatic, very dark, and so powerful. What do you do for somebody in that situation, right? I mean, it's not Hollywood. You don't just throw a little holy water on them and walk away from that door. How long and intensive does the work become in trying to help heal this person and heal their home, heal what's happening to them?
Well, the thing is that I started studying the Inca Best, and a lot of the information out there is inaccurate according to what I've experienced in the field. But it's the thing is, like, I pick an analogy of like a spider. It has like a harem of women that it attacks, and it's connected to all these women anywhere in the world. But it does have a physical, geographical place that it hangs out and works from there. That house happened to be a place that harbored an incubus. And so it would randomly go and attack these women all the time. And it feeds off that sexual energy. So what happens is, when I was talking to Pam, and she told me, she says, these women are addicted to the sexual rape. And I said, that's nonsense. How can that be? It makes no sense. And she didn't have an answer for me. But later on, what I decided to do was I got a hold of that ghost group again. I said, hey, I need you guys to come out here, bring this equipment out. I got to see what's going on in this house. I mean, are we getting a lot of EMF, you know, causing hallucination? And I said, I've got to figure out what's going on here. So a Detroit group came out, and they set up all the cameras and stuff. And I said, now, I know you don't believe in demons, but please do not bring your wife. This thing attacks women. Don't bring your wife. So what's he do? He brings his wife. So we set up all the equipment in the place, and we're getting a lot of EMF. I mean, very high EMF. And it's not like bleeding through where the circuit box is. I mean, it's very well insulated there. But I mean, it's all through the house, like the outlets, very high EMF. And he determined that it was a bad ground. And as we were doing collecting our data, he just said, you know, I'm calling it. This is just nothing but just electrical. That's all it is. And so I'm standing there with Pam, and we start walking upstairs. And I says, something's bothering me, Pam. She goes, what? And I says, this demon doesn't act like it did when we were here. I mean, we were getting fireworks over here. Why is it so damn quiet all of a sudden? And she says, I don't know. And then all of a sudden it dawned on me, it's hunting. And that woman is there. Where is Carol? So I'm calling out to her husband. Is she down there? He says, no, I haven't seen her. I thought she's up there with you. Nobody knew where she was. So we quickly ran upstairs, Pam and I, and went into the living room. And on the steps, there she is sitting. And she swam back and forth. And she just looked like she's drunk out of her mind. And Pam went up to touch her, and when she did, I saw this big electrical arc shoot off from her. And I'm talking to the woman, and I says, Carol, and I said, Carol, what are you feeling? She says, oh, Joe, this is wonderful. It feels so good. I haven't felt anything like this. It's so stress-free. There's nothing malevolent about this at all. And the psychic's withering says, no, it's attacking you. You've got to break it. I don't care how good it feels. You've got to break it. So this went on for a little while. The husband came upstairs. He was disturbed by the sight. He didn't know what to do. So finally he says, you know, we're done. We're out of here. So grab all the equipment, break it down. So his people are breaking all the equipment down. And meanwhile, we take her into the kitchen. We get her up. And I happen to have that. Oh, I forgot to tell you that when I had that crucifix, when we originally were there, it's all made out of iron. And Pam was holding it flat in the palm of her hand, and the iron hand to the Christ figure snapped off and fell to the floor. Just to tell you, I forgot about that part. So I still had this crucifix.
That little aspect of a story, sure. Holy cow.
I'm sorry. So I went up and I pulled the crucifix out, and I said to Carol, I said, what is your religion, Carol? She said, well, I'm a Christian. And I handed her the crucifix. And as soon as I did, she screamed bloody murder and dropped it. And I, of course, you know, being probably heavily influenced by Hollywood, think, oh, my God, it burned her hand, you know, but it didn't. It was creating this pain in her head, and her left side of the brain is where she was feeling the pain, and it started breaking that connection. Later on, I could figure out was it actually was creating a chemical change to the brain. Like, you know, when you listen to music, it creates chemical changes to the brain. And it was dulling that left side of the brain, and the right side of the brain, the emotional part, was becoming very intense. And by giving her that and her reminding her of her religion, it started to break that bond free. So we ended up leaving the home. The husband was a bit upset, and he wanted to, let's go to a restaurant. We got it somewhere. So well after midnight, we did find something. And we went there, and we're sitting there in the restaurant, and she's very dehydrated, and she's got a very bad headache. And I said, Carol, knowing that if you went back to that house, that you would be raped, would you go back? And she says, in a heartbeat. I said, is that addicting? She says, yes, it is. And then it made sense. These women are addicted to the rape. It's because of the euphoria that the incubus causes. So
even though it's traumatic, it's horrifying and a violation of who they are at their core, it becomes an intoxicating effect.
Yeah. I mean, I have a psychologist I work with that used to do a lot with serial killers. And there was one that used to use a drug that would have an effect on the left side of the brain and eventually become paralyzed eventually. And what they would do, this would give them a feeling of euphoria. And then the individual would rape them and then kill them. Well, the woman survived. One of her clients survived it. And she had this great guilt based upon the fact that she enjoyed it because of the euphoria. And that was what was happening with these women. But it does start off first as absolute terror, you know, the torture of it all. And then it creates the euphoria, and then it does the act. And the husband, I remember we're sitting in the house, and he says to me, well, they won't rape her here because we're here. I says, are you kidding me? The demon will probably get off on it. You know, I said, you can't think that way. We got to get her out of here. So
do you think that he was kind of under the influence as well? Was he, or is it just the human ego and element of not seeing the fallibility of what he was really up against?
Well, he's a control type guy, and it was out of control. He didn't understand it. He doesn't like demons. He doesn't want anything to do with it. And that's really what it was.
Does? I don't think it had anything. Who does like demons, Joseph?
What?
He does like demons. That's crazy. Wow. No, I get it. So he just thought in denial was the best way to go.
Yes, sir. That'd be the okay. best.
So that was just your first encounter with the demonic realm. Our guest, the author of Demons, A Secular Look, Joseph Stewart. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, why didn't this man run? Why did he feel compelled to continue his journey and research into the demonic? What happens next? You'll have to stay tuned to find out right here on Darkness Radio. Welcome back to the program. Thank you for joining us. I'm your host, Dave Schrader, along with me, Tim Dennis. So, Tim, I got to ask you, if you're out doing a basic investigation and have an encounter like our guest Joseph Stewart did mm-hmm. with his first encounter with the demonic realm, would that compel you to stay in that field and continue your journey? Or would that be the time you think, you know what, maybe it's time to just, I don't know, pick up tiddlywinks or, competitive battleship as a hobby?
I don't know that it makes me quit completely, but I might take a breather for a little bit.
Yeah, I think the demonic realm is the part that I'm not keen on. I don't like to give that kind of power to that realm and to, you know, put myself in the crosshairs, maybe because I've got kids and things, and I just have that fear of how the repercussions might affect them. Joseph Stewart, our guest, he's a demon hunter. He's somebody that elected to stay in the field, that elected to drive further and try to bring help to these people that were dealing with these dark forces. Joseph, you see a case like this. Was your initial thought, oh, I'm out? Or did this compel you to want to help immediately and to get a handle on this?
Well, what happened is a friend of mine was actually the target of this thing. Jason, who was boyfriend to Brenda, who owned the home. And later on, he calls me up on the phone and tells me that this cat, this tabby cat, showed up in his house. And it was an odd cat because it had these big green eyes that glowed. And immediately I went into a panic. I told him, I said, don't look at the eyes. Don't look at the eyes. But I had a feeling he had been under manipulation of this thing because he'd lived it for 3 years with this thing. So other people were seeing it as well with the green eyes. And eventually we decided, because there was a lot of things that started happening to him. His health is going bad. This man used to be a bodybuilder, 205 pounds, 17-inch biceps, and he looked like a Holocaust victim, you know, months later. It was just wasting away, and we had to do something.
Literally eating him away like a cancer.
Yeah, because what they do is they don't rape men. Well, they do under certain circumstances, but basically what it was doing was it was paying him back. How dare you show up at my lair and do what you did. And it was a payback. And so I decided, you know what we're going to have to do? We're going to have to exercise this thing out of his lair. Let's break this web down. Let's get him out of there, hoping that it will stop what's going on. Well, this home that he lived in was quite large, 6,500 square feet. And it was built back in 1859, the original house. And I was kind of made a tactical error. I should have cleansed that house first. We made the attempt to do so, to seal it up for anything like that, to be able to get in. But it was so large, and the people that we required, we couldn't get. So we decided, like, well, maybe it'll be okay. Well, it wasn't. So anyways, we had already done a house exorcism in another case. And basically, it's just being able to, you have to have everybody involved in this. They especially live in the home that are connected to it. And it's all written up in the book as far as how that process went and how we went about it. So this is what we were going to do with this home. So it's important for him to be with us. Now, he's Christian. So we did all this in a Christian context because that's where his strength comes from. So we go back to the house. Well, before we get there, everybody starts coming down with these bad headaches and nausea. And we were trying to communicate by phone, and the cell phones kept hanging up, lost phone numbers. It was just crazy. We're trying to coordinate this thing. And it's like Pam, who was coming up from another city, she was taking a long time. She kept stopping the car because she thought something kept telling her something wrong with the car. And she'd get out, check the tires and that, and be fine. She'd drive so many miles and it would happen again. And she did this all the way in. And then she couldn't find her cell phone. And we're trying to call this other guy, Steve, who was part of the group that was going to bring the sage. And we had holy water, holy oil, everything he needed for a Christian exorcism of the home. And so we finally managed to get together and we drove to the location. And everybody's just had this sickening headache. And I get to the back door to go in, and the first vision that comes to my mind is I see this cobra snake on the circuit breaker box where I have to grab and pull the handle. And I'm thinking like, well, wait a minute now. I had that shuck thing appear, but it had to be an hallucination. It couldn't have been real. And I said to Pam, I says, Pam, is it possible if I get bit by hallucination that I could die from it? And she looked at me like, I have no clue. So the plan was, we think this thing was feeding on electricity. All indication is that. We needed to get down in that basement and shut the power off before we started the exorcism.
Now, wait a minute, Joseph, when you saw this cobra, was it a mind's eye seeing it, like you were sensing that it was there, or did you see a physical manifestation of it?
Mind's eye. I wasn't even in the house yet. I wasn't in the house. I saw it like in a vision that it's down there curled up on this electrical box. That's what I saw. I never physically saw it, no.
Okay, just looking for clarification on this. All right, please continue.
Yeah, so I took it as, okay, it's just a distraction. I said, we're going in. So Steve and I rushed the stairs. He took the lead. We got into the area, and he managed to pull the power off, and, you know, nothing happened. It was like, okay, that's cool. Everything's – but we're still suffering from these headaches and nausea feelings. We get grouped together. We go up and we start this exorcism. And basically what we did is we went from room to room, cleansing the room and sealing it and the windows, basically to drive it out of the house. So we had to move through the environment in such a way, just treating it as if there's actually a physical thing there, moving it from upstairs to downstairs, moving it from the downstairs and leaving the basement opened up, because there was a stairwell that went right straight out the back door, and that's what we wanted the final exit to be. And so we just did this, and we were having all these issues and these distractions and these manipulations that were going on. We finally get to the basement part, and we push it out the door. I mean, just the whole thing, you know, this energy just went out the door. And we sealed it, so it couldn't get back in. The house was so different. I mean, it was so light. Energy was so light. It was just amazing. This thing was hopefully gone and looking for another place to hang out. Well, my friend Jason was just on top of the world. I'd never seen him as ecstatic and happy as he was. He brought us lunch, and we just talked about it. And I'm sitting there, you know, enjoying the victory. But something in the back of my mind kept saying, like, you know what? That was way too easy. I'm not sure that things happen the way I think they happened. But, you know, let's just enjoy the victory, which we did. And so I get home. It was 9 hours later. Jason's home. He calls me on the phone, and he's like all broken up. He can barely talk. And he says, Joe, it's here. And I said, well, you mean that cat's back? And he says, no, it's here. The incubus is here. It's been beating on me. It's been cutting me. It's been torturing me. I've been vomiting nonstop for several hours. And this is my first chance that I've got a break from it torturing me. And I says, well, I'll be over there right away. He says, no, don't come. If you come, it will kill me. And it has a message for you. You're a dead man. And then he hung up. So I'm like, wow. I was going to call the other team members, but I thought, no, what are they going to do? Let them enjoy, you know, a little victory we had, but this is far from being over. So this is the thing that kept me in this demonic stuff. And at that point, I had to figure out, how do I defeat this thing? How do you defeat something that can read your mind and knows every little tactic you're going to pull? How right. do you do that? You know, so we did end up going, and I said, well, there's our tactical errors. We did not do his home. So I got everybody together and I said, let's try this again. Let's get him out of the house. And it was a huge place. And it took like 3.5-4 hours to do. And everybody was losing focus. People weren't doing what they were supposed to do. This thing was just manipulating the hell out of us. So towards the end, we get it down into the main area where it's going to go out the door and it's going to seal it. as I'm staying with Pam, Steve is just like an autopilot. He's going through the area and he immediately seals the door of the exit. The demon is sealed into the house. And we're just like in shock. We're looking at each other. I said, what the hell do we do? And I said, I don't care. Let's just continue on as if it's, you know, still can push it out. Well, we couldn't. It was there. And then that's when all hell broke loose. And this man, just his life was just in misery. And I had to find out, how do I defeat this thing? And that's how my journey started into the demonic.
That's unbelievable. And you know, now that you decide to enter that world, are you fearful that you put yourself into the crosshairs, you become a target, or your family? Because now you're dealing in a realm that's, you know, these things aren't going to be happy that you're mucking with them.
Oh, yeah, I know. We always make a joke like, in hell, my picture's on the most wanted list on the board down there. I am a target. I have been a target. I met my wife during this time period, and she's wonderful psychic, and she has this connection with the demonic. She can hear them. She can see them. She can communicate with them. And in order to handle the demonic, just like it says, you have to know their names. And she just has affinity for getting their names. So we started working together as a team and continued on. And we've been doing it up to today. We're still doing it. Still doing it. So I ended up taking a case down in Tennessee,
mm-hmm.
in Appalachia.
So this just inspired you to help. This, there was no hesitation. There was commitment. This opened a fire in you to help and be a part of something that, you know, a lot of people should not venture into lightly.
Correct. I had to save my friend any way I could.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was down in Tennessee doing a case down there.
Well, let me ask you, before you get into that too deeply, I want to get to that story. But I have a question for you. For people that bill themselves as demonologists, and I recently worked with a team that had some demonologists on it. And, you know, they were very competent, confident people. And after they went in and tried to deal with this, they called back for help because they had an attachment now.
Yes.
I'd just like you to tell people the reality of what it means. You know, we've often said this isn't the X Games of the paranormal. This isn't just a bigger thrill ride. And you should really feel a calling to this. This should be something that is not just a hobby to you. This isn't something that you take lightly. What is your advice to people that say they want to be demonologists or want to step to that forefront?
Well, they really need to do a lot of research because the information that's out there is not correct. And it's very heavily colored by dogma, especially the Christian dogma, because of the Catholics and all the wonderful work they've done in exorcisms. And Hollywood, of course, has misdirected a lot of or misled us as far as what the knowledge is. Well, they don't really know what's going on, but, you know, you always think like, oh, like with the movie The Exorcist, there's just one demon, you know, and it's got a biblical name or, you know, whatever, Pazuzu. Well, it's not like that. They travel in gangs, and they're chaotic, they're arrogant, they're hateful. And you don't even have to be psychic. If you walk into an environment that's actually got an active demon in it, you can feel that. And they're always trying to overthrow the leader of the gang. And so they're always, it's like a pack of dogs just fighting each other all the time. And that's their natural state. So you've got to understand the psychology of them. And that's why I approached it, is as I did my cases throughout the years and work with my wife, I have to look at it as far as how do we affect people. I study their behaviorism through how they affect people in the environment. And I start learning how they work, how they think. So there's a lot to it. I would suggest, I'm not pushing the book, but if they read the book, they will get a lot better understanding of what's going on. This is all empirical. This is all from the field. And I have taken...
we are pushing the book. I want people to know that. There's much more to this. Demons, A Secular Look. It's out and available now. We have a link to it in our program guide, so you can find it easily enough and get it. Please rate and review it as well. But we are pushing the book because there's a lot more to what you share. 256 pages of heavily detailed information and your stories. It's something I think that people should research from somebody that's been in that field and has had to deal with it, so they know really what it is that they're up against when they face a demon, and more importantly, what it is to face that, to be the person that they call on for help. It isn't something you should take lightly.
That is correct. The book was initially, when I was, as I'm binding these demons, I realize there's just too many of them, and the only thing I can do that makes sense is to write the book as a warning to the human race that these things really exist, and they coexist with us, and a lot of our human miseries are due to these things. I don't care what culture you come from, what race you are, it makes no difference. Whether you're a child, an older person, a younger person, it made no difference. Everything is target for them. They're predators.
Yeesh. That's, yeah, and that's something you got to think about, folks. Again, this isn't meant to be a game. This is real life, and it's real scary. All right, you were starting to go into another story, and I'm sorry I distracted you from that, but I wanted people to get a real vibe for this. And this isn't a hero moment. This isn't something you should take lightly. So I just wanted people to get that sense from you, somebody who's actually done this.
Well, what the Tennessee case did for me is it taught me something that led me to the concept of binding, a way to defeat the demon.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was down in Tennessee, there was a thing there known as the Dark Man. And it was harassing this family. And it seemed to be some guy, a boyfriend to this man's mother-in-law, who had found a doll in some abandoned building that looked like it had satanic markings on it. And there was something attached to it. He brought it back to the house, gave it to the gentleman's his name was Chris, that had contacted us. And he wiped all the markings off and gave it to the young girl. She didn't want anything to do with it. She kept tossing it out of her crib. And one morning he came in there and she had a razor blade in her mouth. And he says, "I don't even have razor blades in the house." And he couldn't figure out how that was happening. And so just things got worse and worse and worse with these people. So we made the trip down there. And the objective was to remove this thing from the environment and to put it somewhere where it won't harm anybody. And that's exactly what we did. But in the meantime, we were doing that. And it got quite exciting because we were driving from Michigan down to Tennessee. It was like about a 10-hour drive to where we were going. And the closer we got to the place, we got a call from them, and they were saying that they thought we were going to show up the next night, but we wanted to surprise them. And they called up and were saying this thing, it's pounding on the house. They can see it in the window. It's trying to get in, and everybody's screaming. And Chris went into the room where his children were, and one of the children, I think she was 3 years old, was choking. There was a rubber glove that was shoved down her throat. And he got that. They were all in a panic. So we let them know, we're coming. We're like about an hour away. And it was just like, God, it was just like they kept moving that place further and further away as they were trying to get there. Well, when we got there, this woman that was there, Selena, who was staying with him, he was helping her out and giving her a place to stay. And she was standing defiantly on the deck with this dowel between her legs. At the floor on the deck. And I thought, well, that's really odd. There's something strange going on here. So Steve runs up, grabs the dowel, and we put it into a container. So we put it into a vehicle. And they had this bloodhound that seemed to be aware of the demonic, and that dog circled and circled that car. You know how a dog kind of leans forward, like it's going to shoot backwards, you know, like it's not quite sure, and it was doing this around this car until we left. Well, we had the demon's name by then, and we bound it or gave it commands that you can't do anything to us, you can't escape from this, etc. And we took the demon out of the environment. So we told the people, I says, look, we'll come back in the morning and we'll go through the house and we'll do a smudging and everything that you have to participate in. And then we'll leave. Well, at that time, when we got there, it's 10 o'clock in the morning, and Selena comes to the door and she goes like, oh, I'm sorry, Chris is sleeping, you know. I'm sorry, we can't. I have to watch the babies. We can't come. I says, what do you mean? I said, we drove hundreds of miles to come down here to help you guys out, and we have to get back, get him out of bed. And so she finally went and got him out of bed, and he came up. He's all sleepy-eyed, and I says, we have to do this. Now, there was something strange about this woman, this Selena. She's sitting there. She's still got this hatred look on her face. The dogs are all nervous. They had put them in the pens. They were nipping at us. They were just overly excited. And she kept rocking on the couch and saying, I got to take care of the babies. I got to take care of the babies. But she wouldn't do anything. Now, Pam was with us, and she went into the room and changed the diapers to the children and cleaned the place up for them. But the woman just kept sitting there doing that. So I said, okay, let's start this cleansing. And I did a quick look around the house to see what was going on. I went into Selena's room, and it was dark as a cave. And that was my first clue. Something's not right here. And I went to the other end of the room where this thing always came from. And there was a closet there, and that's where it hung out. And up in the there was like a pipe, like a cold water pipe that went up the side of the wall. And there's this big butcher knife placed between the wall and that, just sitting there. And I'm like, wow, what the hell's that there for? So I just, you know, I said, I'll just keep make note of it. So we next started the smudging, and I slept. I broke them up in teams, and I just supervised. And the next thing I know, they're socializing and talking about stuff, and Selena's back on the couch, and I could see they're being manipulated. They're being distracted. So I call everybody together, and I says, get back to it. Let's start over again. And I was standing over top of them, make sure things got done. And at one point, Selena, I'm watching her, and she's doing the cross with holy water, but she never actually took any holy water out, and she feigned doing this.
And
at the time, she's growling, and I'm looking at Steve, and he's looking at me, and I says, are you hearing that? There's something wrong here. So we get into the main room where I told you that knife was, and she's standing there, and we said, well, okay, we want you to seal this mirror. And she says, I can't do it. Why can't you do it? There's something there. It's horrifying. It's a monstrous thing. It's there. I can't do it. And that's when we got all of a sudden the idea, like, okay, wait a minute, something's going on here. We have another possession going on. And at that time, I didn't know they traveled in gangs. And we were trying to figure it out, because one of the things that these people experience is they get a headache, and it starts like at the back of your skull, at the base of your skull. It's very dull, and it'll work its way up through your temples and like into the sinuses. And it's like this demon at that point is like connecting to you. Well, Chris was complaining about that at 2 o'clock in the morning. And I said, that can't be right, because we're in the mountains and we buried this demon. And I don't see how it can be connected to it, because it was bound for sure. And so something else is going on. And so we need to do a deliverance. So that's a non-Catholic form of an exorcism. And this time I'm using two people. I says, all right, Steve, I want you to do the prayers, and I want you to work on the demon. And Pam, I want you to contact this girl, because your best exorcist is your victim. And I want you to get her to consciousness. I want you to encourage her to fight this thing. And so we got this thing going. Now, I will say that the sign of the demon is 333. Shows up everywhere when you're dealing in demonology. And we start the process. And Chris is standing there while it's going on. And all of a sudden, Chris starts talking about, we were doing it for a little while, and Chris is talking about, like, oh, I'm getting a headache. I'm getting a headache. And I said, where is it? He said, the back of my neck. And I knew, uh-oh, this thing is trying to take over. And he turns around and says, well, I got to go check on something. And I grabbed him, and he was heading for the closet. And I said, no, you're not going anywhere. You're coming right back here and continue on. And all of a sudden, the headache was gone, and things picked up again with her. It was like trying to jump him. And I don't know if he's going to the closet for the knife or whatever it was, but that's what happened. So we're standing there, and it's 10 o'clock in the morning, or it's probably about 10:30, something around there. And we're looking at his radio clock, and all of a sudden, it started flashing 333. And I said to him, he looks at me, and he goes like, is that thing doing what I think it's doing? Yes, it is. It's a distraction. Focus on what we're doing. And everybody starts looking at it. Now, in the meantime, I don't know if you're familiar with this, but when you're doing a traditional exorcism, sometimes the demon attempts to put you asleep. And I'm watching Steve as he's doing this. Now, he's got this rosary, and he's Catholic as well. And he's got it in the back of the neck of this woman. And he says, it is burning the hell out of my hand as I'm having a hard time keeping it at the base of the skull. And she's looking at him, and she says, should it burn like that? And I said, no, it shouldn't, but please tolerate it for now. Well, as time went on, Steve starts getting droopy-eyed. He starts losing his, and he's falling. He's kind of staggering backwards like he's going to fall asleep. And I'm trying like hell to break him out of it. And he'd break out of it. And I said, go back to it. So this went on. And finally, the woman started becoming more conscious and aware of it. And Pam is coaching her on, you know, you got to fight, you got to fight. And we found out all kinds of things that she regretted. She found out she was doing a blood ritual that called this thing in. She had lost a baby, and she was depressed about that. And that was the reason for the blood ritual. And it just escalated from there. And she was asking for forgiveness. And eventually, the thing just went away. So the woman immediately started vomiting. She vomited for like almost an hour. Finally, we were standing outside afterwards, and everybody was just kind of like, wow, relaxing from it. And she came out totally different person, just charming and sweet. Her whole demeanor had totally changed, and it was just amazing to see. So this is what gave me the idea, maybe I can bind this demon in the sense like a genie in a bottle type thing. So that's where I started experimenting, and that was when I knew this is the answer I have. I can defeat this incubus. I just got to find its name.
How hard is that to uncover? I can't guess they're real willing to give that up.
Well, my wife, Dorinda, she comes up with these names, and I can always tell when it does, because it's just you get some sort of phenomenon in the environment, and they start cussing at her and swearing at her because they figured out the name. And this particular demon, I actually came up with the name. I don't know how it happened. I was going to work, and I just happened to cross an alley, and all of a sudden the name came. It was almost like somebody wrote white letters on a blackboard, and I saw the name and I wrote it down, and I knew that was the name. And then later on, I went to my wife Dorinda, and I says, and she confirmed, yes, that's the name. So we ended up doing the binding, and we did bind that incubus, and that was the end of its story. It was gone for good. I mean, the story is more in detail, of course, but
right, of course, right. A lot more in the book. And again, we have a link to the book. It's called Demons, A Secular Look. The author of this book, our guest today, Joseph Stewart. Joseph, man, thanks. What a way to kick off our October month. Scary tales. You're an amazing storyteller, and we appreciate you coming on to share the insights and stories behind this. If you could, though, real quickly, and if you could just give us a couple of bullet points. A lot of people mistake paranormal activity for something demonic because it's a little unnerving to them. What are three real elements to you that let you know that what you're dealing with is truly demonic in nature?
Well, the main one that's guaranteed is my wife. If she walks in and says there's a demon there and senses it, knows it's there.
Right, but for those of us that don't have your wife with us, what is something?
I know what you mean.
Right.
There is usually chaos in the environment, almost like a hoarder. There is, when a psychic comes in, it's always something there, but they can't put their finger on it. They can't identify it in that sense. Sometimes you get the telltale signs of initially an abundance of flies, an abundance of mice, an abundance of moths. Like, this is way too many moths or mice or whatever, things like that into the environment. And it just, that's kind of the main things that I look for when I go in. And I think too, there's just since I've been doing it for so long and I've been in contact with these things for so long, I get a sense of them now that I didn't before.
Okay. And I understand that's for you to identify. But if me, the person that's at home, thinks I've got something, what would be some telltale signs for me that, yep, this is a demon as opposed to just an angry ghost or a ghost?
Well, could you tell me, did you have a case where you thought something like that? What was it you were experiencing?
No, not me specifically. I'm just, you know, as somebody that's dealt in this, I didn't know if you're like, hey, yeah, if you're, you know, if there are physical scratches, if there is this, if there's that, I just didn't know if there are a few easy telltale signs that you could pass on to people just to either alleviate their fear that, no, you're not dealing with a demon, it's probably a ghost, as opposed to it. I mean, so if I start using religious evocation in my house or have things like that and they start, you know, start amping up, is that a good sign? You know, kind of like, you might be a redneck if, that's my concept here, right? You might be demonically possessed or dealing with a demon if your body levitates 4 feet above your bed, right? I mean, there's got to be some real telltale signs for people. Is it easy to tell, or sometimes is it very cloaked and hard to discern that it's a demon until you're in the thick of it?
Yeah, it's not that easy to tell. Usually the people that are victims will have like a lot of terror nightmares, scratches, but you know, ghosts do that too, but it's usually everything in threes, knocks of threes. You'll get a lot of that phenomena, you know, with a port, all that type of stuff taking place. So yeah, it's not that easy, because the thing of the demon is to remain unknown. That's its strength, is you do not believe in it. You don't think it's there. That gives it free rein to do what it wants. So it works its way to remain hidden. And a lot of people do have a demonic issue and they think it's a ghost, but in reality it's not. Especially if you see children ghosts. That sets up a red flag with me. Ghosts are children.
Yeah, that's been one that's always kind of set my hackles on edge as well. You know, I'm a caring dad, and I try to show respect to children's ghosts and realize that there are elements that will be the case. But folks, be careful. I've watched in many locations where people think they're encountering a child's ghost, and they make the offer, oh, I'm a parent. You can come home with me. You don't have to stay in the scary. That's exactly what they want, is that opening. And so,
let me just say that demons, you don't have to get demons, you have to invite them in. That's nonsense. They will come and invite them. They're predators. So they got an opportunity, they're going to take it.
Very cool. Very weird, actually. But Joseph, thank you so much for coming on today and spreading some of this knowledge and wealth. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, folks. Quick little sideline. As we're doing this, I'm sitting in my room, and I've told you that I am in a hotel room in an undisclosed location filming a new series. But as our guest was telling his first story, in my room, not outside my room, not from another floor, but in my room, I heard something laugh. So, after we get done with this phone call, I'll be smudging myself, which sounds pretty dirty now that I've said it out loud, but I'll be making sure we clean this room, clear my area, and I might be moving into another hotel real soon. Keep tuned. Thank you very much for tuning in and spending some time with us here. We will be back again next week with more of the best in paranormal talk radio, the Afterlife Frequency. Mark Anthony, our guest next week, plus Parashare and Supernatural News and True Crime Tuesday. We are the best in talk. Talk Radio. We are Darkness Radio.